This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and Boston Mayor Michelle Wu will join us this hour. We'll have her in a few minutes. First, Boston Herald columnist Joe Battenfeld is here to help us set that up. Joe, welcome back.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Great to have you here. Joe, what is the biggest issue on Mayor Wu's plate right now?
I think really the most pressing matter right now is masks and casks. The situation continues to deteriorate down there. It's getting worse. They found a toddler down there wandering around. There continues to be crime down there, serious crimes. And meanwhile, the city council appears to be like dithering on it and not doing anything. They postponed another action on it this week, and they're waiting until the last minute to do anything. And frankly, I don't think Mayor Wu should wait for the council. I don't think she needs to wait for the council. I think she can do something on her own and clear out the tents down there without the council's, waiting for a vote by the council. I think, action needs to be done right now.
So the mayor, of course, has this ordinance that she's proposed that would allow the city to clear out tents faster than the 48-hour waiting period that's there now. The city council meets today. Mayor Wu was waiting for a vote on it, and Ricardo Arroyo, outgoing city councilor, responsible for shepherding that in. The Herald's reporting he has COVID and has postponed that vote. Joe, I don't know city council functioning well enough to know. Did Arroyo have to postpone the vote because he wasn't going to be there, or was that a choice?
No, I think that was a choice. I mean, obviously I hope he's doing okay, with COVID and everything, but they have a majority of councilors to deal with it, and he is the chair of one committee, but I think the ordinance can go through without him. And I don't even think Mayor Wu needs this ordinance, to be honest. I think she's giving way too much leeway to the council to postpone this. And I think she should have done something. This has been in August since she proposed this ordinance. It's getting colder every day out there. People are, still in the tents, and I think more action needs to be done right now.
We're here with Boston Herald columnist Joe Battenfeld as we prepare to speak with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. Joe, I'm going to add a second voice now. Emma Platoff is a politics reporter with the Boston Globe. Emma, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Emma, Joe Battenfeld's just laid out, he thinks the number one issue on Boston Mayor Michelle Wu's plate right now is the area around Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard. We've kind of laid that out. What else? What's another huge issue that you think the mayor is facing and needs to address?
Well, one of the most pressing area crises for Mayor Michelle Wu and for Governor Healey as well is, of course, housing. We just saw the governor this morning lay out her plan for a multi-billion-dollar housing bond bill, including many of the policies Wu herself has proposed. So it would allow for localities to levy a new transfer tax on high-dollar real estate sales. They could use that money to build things like affordable housing. That's something Boston has long been advocating for. So interesting to see how the mayor reacts to that and whether she's, eager to see traction on some of those housing policies at the State House.
So one of the things that I'm mindful of, Emma, is that technically the current year legislative session on Beacon Hill ends technically on November 15th. And Mayor Wu has a number of home rule petitions that affect some of her strategies, including around housing, still waiting for the legislature to move on. So, one, do you expect movement? And two, does this housing bond bill, take action on anything having to do with those home rule petitions?
On some of those home rule petitions, I certainly would not be holding my breath. One of the most prominent issues for Mayor Wu has been rent control. The city council sent that proposal to Beacon Hill months ago, and we just have really seen no indication that leaders at the State House are interested in taking on that policy, which has been quite controversial. But on other places, there does seem to be more room for agreement. We hadn't really seen until today as explicit a commitment from the Healey administration that there is interest in doing something like a transfer fee. So, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu had sent up her own version of what she would like a transfer fee to look like for Boston. We hadn't seen that really move, but I think this openness from the administration to allowing local officials to enact that policy certainly is a good sign for folks in places like Boston that have been advocating for that for a long time.
So turning back to you now, Joe Battenfeld of the Boston Herald, you know, you brought up the Boston City Council, its vote on the ordinance that Boston Mayor Michelle Wu put forward for the area around Mass and Cass. I want to talk about the City Council itself as well. We talk to Mayor Wu once a month, right? It's middle of October. Most likely, we'll probably talk to her around middle of November, which means November elections will have happened, which means we will have a new Boston City Council. You know, one of the questions that comes up about that new council is, will it be made up differently in terms of its progressive balance versus moderate balance? Do you expect that the mayor will have a different city council, substantially different city council to work with, and how that might affect her agenda, Joe Battenfeld? So we might have lost Joe Battenfeld there. So same question that I am interested in, Emma Platoff of the Boston Globe, and I'll just ask you, same question.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're watching to see how the breakdown of this progressive-leaning council may shift with the November election. The question I really have my eye on, you know, this is Boston. Everyone's a Democrat. Many of these candidates are progressives. I expect that the body we land on come January when folks are sworn in will continue to be a progressive-leaning body. The question for me is, we've seen sort of two breeds of progressive on the Boston City Council, right? There are these sort of outsider progressive voices, folks like Julia Mejia and Kendra Lara, who have been critical of the mayor, at times saying she's not going far enough with her progressive policies. And then there have been progressives on the council, folks like Liz Braden, new councilor Sharon Durkin, who are more allied with the mayor, who are still in that mold, but a little bit more likely to go along with or be aligned with what the mayor has proposed. And we've seen Boston Mayor Michelle Wu wade into council elections this cycle. She's endorsed a number of candidates. We saw that those endorsements proved powerful in the preliminary round in September. So my question really is how much more aligned with her the council will become January.
All right. Lots there to think about as we prepare to speak with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. Emma Platoff, politics reporter with the Boston Globe, and we had Joe Battenfeld, columnist with the Boston Herald. Emma, thanks for helping us set it up. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and with us now, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. Mayor Wu, good to have you on the line. Welcome back.
Nice to be with you, as always.
So, Mayor Wu, so much I want to talk to you about, and we kind of have this overarching question, which is, in this moment, are our policies keeping up with our needs? But before we do that, I feel like I want to check in with you first about what you are hearing from the residents of the city of Boston who are Israeli-American, Palestinian-American, worried about loved ones on the ground in the conflict that is unfolding halfway across the world.
It really feels like there are so few degrees of separation these days, just in the kind of connectedness, and in Boston being such an international city and one with such strong personal ties to the region. I don't think I've talked to a single person who doesn't know someone who knows someone, at least, or is personally impacted with family members. We have been trying our best to help those who have loved ones who are trying to evacuate from Gaza or from Israel, and been in touch with our federal partners to make those connections. And and then on the ground here, there's really a palpable sense of course, strong grief and mourning throughout the community, and also worry and anxiety about what that translates into in terms of hateful incidents or backlash or worse. And so we've been working very closely on the safety and security of our communities on the ground here. Boston is going to be a place where everyone is safe and where all of our views and perspectives have the space to be in conversation without any tolerance for threats or hatred.
I'm I'm glad you brought that up, Mary Wu, and I want to set this up a little bit. Research from Brandeis, according to a 2015 Jewish community study, Greater Boston is home to the fourth largest Jewish community in the country. It is less clear how large our Palestinian American community here is in Boston and New England from a research perspective, but we know that it is also substantial, and we know that this is conversation is fraught, as we have seen, you know, on the ground here in the community over the last week and a half. We reached out to our texting group, and you can join that by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. And Alex in Brighton sent in this question, making attempts to increase cooperation and ties between the Jewish, Israeli, and Palestinian communities in Boston?
I've been in several different spaces in community and, whether it is services or in different spaces where people are gathering to talk about the issues and just be together in person. And I think on the ground, I've heard from everywhere about the strong commitment and determination, hope that our city can really continue to be a place where everyone is welcome. And even in these just horrific situations and the ongoing complexity hour by hour abroad, that we can have space for people to share how they're feeling and how they're doing and to share some understanding with their neighbors here in Boston.
Let's talk about safety, you know, concerns about violence, threats. So, for example, the Massachusetts chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations is calling for an investigation after the word Nazis was spray painted over the sign for the Palestinian Cultural Center for Peace. They're calling it a possible hate crime. We know that Boston Police told WCVB that they responded to the Palestinian Cultural Center for Peace and the Islamic Seminary of Boston, and that they're increasing patrols in the area. How do you keep everyone safe, especially as the conflict continues and more people are going to be hurt, more people are going to die, tensions are going to go up? This is hard, hard stuff. What do you do to keep people safe?
Yeah, and we've already seen across the country the potential for violence and for such depravity that can come with hate when it is acted upon, thousands of miles away from what's happening in Israel and Gaza, with the 6-year-old little boy and his mother who were attacked and who lost his life in Illinois, which seems to be, from the news reports so far, motivated by a racist and hateful act of violence. And we have experienced in Boston incidents of, for example, with this graffiti, or in months and years past, anti-Semitic incidents, violence that has taken place in outside some of the houses of worship and religious schools in our neighborhoods. And so the way for safety, as always, is through community and being in close contact with our community members on the ground. We are working very closely with Boston Police and with our community safety efforts and all of our community partners, just to understand, either for houses of worship throughout whenever services are taking place or other events that might be planned. We're in constant contact with synagogues, mosques, groups that are representing community members of all backgrounds, just so we can have the information and then be prepared to support however is makes the most sense.
So, Mayor Wu, before we move on, speak directly to the city today, right? Every day is changing. Today, speak directly to the city of Boston. What do you want to say?
There are so many of our neighbors and friends and family who are directly, personally experiencing the grief and trauma that comes from war and from events that seem like they're far away, but in fact are felt right here in Boston as well, as we watch the unfolding and ongoing loss of life and just horrific violence that's taking place, we need to ensure that in Boston we protect each other. And that means holding fast to what the city stands for, being a safe harbor to all, being a leader when it comes to speaking out, and also creating space for everyone's voices to be heard. So we will continue at the city level to be in communication with all of our community partners, and just want to ask everyone to remember how connected we are and reach out to us at the city level. Reach if there's anything that might just feel a little strange or want extra support. Our job is to be here to ensure the safety and well-being and health of our community across the board.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and I'm here with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu for our monthly conversation. And Mayor Wu, as we were preparing for the conversation with you today, we realized that underscoring so much of what we wanted to talk about was this core question of whether our policies are meeting the moment and the need. And I think I'll start there with the intersection of Malnia, Cass Boulevard, and Massachusetts Avenue. I mean, today is the day that I know you were expecting and hoping for a vote from the Boston City Council on the ordinance that you want. I sat here and waited for you to come out of the press conference when you announced that ordinance so we could talk about it, looking for greater flexibility in removing tents as long as people had someplace else to go, more police presence, a variety of measures. Boston Herald reporting that Ricardo Arroyo, the outgoing city councilor who was sort of charged with stewarding this, postponed the vote from this week after testing positive for COVID. And obviously, we hope that he's okay. But your reactions to the fact that, again, the city council is not voting on this, you brought it forward weeks ago now.
It's disappointing to see such an urgent issue that everyone across the board is hoping to see action on, that the kind of authorization piece has been delayed again. But I will say, even though we were hoping for a vote as soon as possible, we have been planning for the longest possible time frame, because that's just what you need to do to be fully prepared. And this is an example of one of what's called a 60-day order. So when the administration files legislation with the council, it starts a 60-day clock. And if no action is taken within that window, then it automatically goes into effect. And so that 60-day clock will be up after next week's council meeting. So we had been planning for the full 60-day window, and we had, in fact, filed it counting back 60 days from when we were hoping to really begin implementation as we go into the fall and colder weather. So, in fact, we hope we will be on the same timeline and in terms of moving forward with this. And although it would have been nice and I think shown some action around the urgency of this issue, we would have preferred to be able to have more planning time with the ability to notify residents on the ground of what was happening with the maximum time available. But we were planning for this entire window just in case something came up.
You know, indications are within the political continuum of the Boston City Council, and it's a tight range, but indications are that there was disagreement with the ordinance on both ends of that political continuum. Good chance you weren't going to get a favorable vote. So why be disappointed in not getting one? Obviously, if you were going to get a favorable vote, the sooner the better for preparing. But if you're going to get a negative vote, aren't you happier to have them just do nothing?
I mean, that's the council's decision on how to take it. I think we'll get there. I think we've had very thorough and productive conversations through the public hearing and working sessions that have followed, and we've answered many, many questions. Much of the conversation, in fact, wasn't about the ordinance itself, but about the larger plan. And we were happy to use this opportunity to really put that legal language in the context of everything else that was that is going to be taking place as well.
So I'm going to stop you there. Let's parse that out. When you say the concern wasn't about the ordinance, it was about the larger plan. So put that in lay terms for our listeners. What does that mean?
Yes, that's a good point. So the ordinance specifically would codify some changes to Boston Police's authority to participate in the needs at Mass and Cass currently on the books. There's an executive order that was signed shortly before I stepped into the office under then Mayor Kim Janey, which provides the authority to remove tents when there are when there's transportation available and storage for belongings, and a 48-hour notice period for everyone with each tent that is to be removed. That 48-hour window has proven to be very difficult to practically implement when the needs can change so fast, and when in fact we have been conducting clearings of the street, cleanings of the area that involve clearing all of the tents to a different, taking everything down and moving it for a deep cleaning, and then people kind of regather and reconvene. The overall dynamic is such that we need to keep going on the housing and treatment and services part of the infrastructure we've been building, but the public safety piece needs to be able to meet the immediacy of what's happening on the ground. And so even though the ordinance only touches on the public safety authorization, it is in the context of increased shelter beds that will be available and housing that we're creating to absorb a disruption in restoring Atkinson Street to standard roadway functions rather than as an open air gathering spot. And it also is in the context of the ongoing recovery and treatment services that are being offered and placements and referrals that are taking place.
I'm sure you're aware that Boston City Council President Ed Flynn is calling for the Boston Public Health Commission to investigate the circumstances surrounding reports of a 2-year-old who appears spent a night in the area in the presence of reportedly the 2-year-old's mother. Have you been briefed on this? Will there be an investigation? What is your reaction? The reporting that I have read is through the Boston Herald. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is a very visible reminder that the opiate crisis touches everyone. It is people from all backgrounds, from all age groups, and yes, including people who have young children. And so as soon as our health outreach workers saw that there was a child in a vehicle and in the area, they notified the proper authorities and DCF, the state agency around the health and well-being of children, has been involved and is taking the appropriate actions here. But it sounds like a child with their guardian and caregiver who is someone who was in the area, and we can't have gathering spaces like this where we are creating the public risks for everyone involved. And so we're going to continue to provide spaces for people to access housing, treatment, and the health that they and their families need. But there should not be an open convening area where everyone is coming and going, and there are dangerous risks to the health of anyone passing through the area.
One more thing on the intersection at Mass and Cass Marabou, because it's a large issue for the city now, especially as the weather does get colder. There have been reports, again, including in the Herald, of the spreading of encampments to other places. And some concern that if you can remove tents faster, right, you can push people out of that area, it's going to cause spread. Other concern that, you know, as you have talked about before, spread just means there's not enough units for people to go into. This is complicated. It's always complicated. And I don't want to go into the public safety first versus housing first versus treatment first. What I want to understand is, will we see more tents other places? And if we do, will we, are we, and what do you do about it?
This, in some ways, is a very seasonal experience in Boston, in that the housing crisis and the opiate crisis looks and feels different in the winter versus the summer, given temperatures and what it's like to be outside. Every year around this time, we have started to see more of the structures and kind of protection from the elements coming up. And that is a reflection of what we have to do this time of year. The ordinance would apply citywide. Our efforts and the resources that we're putting together would also be citywide. And so the goal is the plans that we've put in place are to make a major transition in the Mass and Cass area on Atkinson Street to remove encampments and connect people to services and really shut down the area as a gathering space and return it to standard roadway operations, but also to have units of our public safety officials and public health officials who are available at a moment's notice citywide in order to connect people to services wherever they may need those services.
Is that realistic? Even if the ordinance passes, right? We are headed into the colder parts of the season. And, you know, if you look at what's happened in the area over the last couple of years, is there anything that can happen at the ordinance level and at the policing and public safety level that is really going to, between, let's say, November 1st and March 31st, really reduce the presence of people who are putting up temporary shelters to try to stay warm in that area in any kind of a significant way, Mayor Wu?
When we, each city, each major city has to do what's called a point in time census count of unsheltered homelessness in the city. The numbers get reported to HUD at the federal level, just so nationally we have an understanding of what the situation is. Last year, when this count happened, Boston was at 119 unsheltered individuals who were staying on the street at that moment when teams fanned out citywide to engage with people who needed services, but also capture that number so that we would have the data for the year.
And that included a full census in the Mass and Cass area?
Yes.
Okay.
119 people is a very manageable number for, relatively speaking, right? Los Angeles was at nearly 25,000 people for their point in time census count. And so, you know, for us in Boston, this is in some ways the most pressing and complex issue. And we are rallying every resource to be able to make a major phase change here. But it is, relatively speaking, at a scale where we can do something about it. And I just want to push back on the sense that this is hopeless or too big of a problem, or, you know, it's been this way for so many years. Yes, we are seeing growing housing costs that are putting more pressure and ending up with more and more people experiencing homelessness. And we are seeing the opiate crisis grow. But we are a city with resources, and we need to marshal the public and political will to ensure that we're continuing to try to address this challenge, even as it is, you know, moving targets and people are coming in from other places. We've created more than 100 additional shelter beds just to be able to manage this transition as we look to open back up Atkinson Street and the Mass and Cass area. Those include spaces for couples. Those include spaces in some of our existing shelters with our partners. They include some beds that are located outside of Boston with our partners, including some dedicated to women in particular. And so we have a plan where there will be a significant staffing surge in the public safety side, in the outreach and public health side, and in the housing resources that are available to make this transition and then maintain our infrastructure to reach people who need those services and support, but without creating an open air area where so much risk can take place and other acts of violence and other criminal activity that can make it unsafe for everyone.
We're here with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu on Radio Boston. So we'll stay in the subject, but we're going to widen the look here and introduce the new complicating factor, Mayor Wu, because it just feels like these days everything has a new complicating factor. On Monday, your Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, Governor Maura Healey makes an announcement saying that we are reaching a point of capacity in the emergency shelter system. We're in two unique situations for our listeners in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. One, we are the only state with the right to shelter law, and we talked about that in depth on the show earlier this week. So people who qualify have a right to shelter, emergency shelter in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And two, that means that we have a state-funded shelter system. As of yesterday, we had 7,023 families across the state enrolled in that. In Boston, according to the same data, there are over 200 enrolled. Governor Healey says by the time we hit 7,500, which we will probably by the end of the month, there will be no more room at the inn, and she's going to move to a wait list. That is remarkable. So we, our texting group, they had some questions. I'll give you two that I'm going to put together. First, Yolette and Randolph said, I'd like to know how she'll house migrants based on Governor Healey's statement about turning away migrants now. I want to be clear, that is not what the governor explicitly said on Monday. It is not clear how she'll prioritize who will be put on a wait list. We do know that part of the strain has been migrants coming from other states into our system. And Will in Cambridge said, will Boston follow the lead of the state and reach out to the federal agencies for emergency housing help? So can Boston act alone on this, Mayor Wu? Will you do what the state is doing and create wait lists? Can you do something differently? And what is your reaction to Governor Healey, given that this is a state law?
We have been working very closely with the governor's administration on this issue because the flow of people coming in is greater than any single city's ability to match the need. We have a significant number of families who we have been very happy to welcome and to find housing and provide services for. And in some ways, some of the non-housing needs that families have, Boston is very well equipped to serve. There are, for the start of this school year, 807 new students who are connected in some ways to the inflow of new families to our country and to our city. And we have, as a school district, we have the seats, we have the language infrastructure, multilingual infrastructure, and social emotional supports infrastructure. So it has not been an extraordinary strain on our school system because we're already set up in this way as a very large district. And I know that's not the same experience for much smaller communities in the Commonwealth with much fewer resources around some of these kind of holistic needs. But on the housing front, it is very difficult, as we were just talking about with our talking about the situation at Mass and Cass. And so the thing to keep in mind about these beds and the space that is available is that it's not a static number of families. And in fact, most of the families who are arriving, I would say when you speak to them, they want to get to work right away to be able to support themselves and to be in contributing members of the community as quickly as possible. And so the faster that we're able to help folks adjust and get situated, and once they start getting a job and earning income, they actually leave this emergency shelter system or emergency housing system and have housing of their own because they're working and filling in the vacancies that we've been looking to fill through our labor shortage anyway.
So Governor Healey has pushed really hard on that. She has said that the big fall down of the federal government is the backlog of work permits. I feel like maybe what I'm hearing you say is, in the short term, we need the federal government to speed up work permits. And until they do, you at least understand Governor Healey's move. Do you agree with Governor Healey's move?
We've been in close contact with some of the federal officials as well and have partnered with the state. For example, when DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, sent a team in town and connected them directly with providers on the ground. So it's a big issue of work authorization and the timeline that it takes. But there are all sorts of little steps that feel like low-hanging fruit that, because our providers and our staff on the ground are living it every day, they were able to report out. For example, most parts of the process you can do online, except the application for a fee waiver. If you can't afford to pay the fees associated with this, you can apply to have that waived. But that fee waiver application isn't online. And so then you still have to go through this mail process and wait for it to come back. And so that was one little thing where they seem very open to making that adjustment or there's a whole number of small things that would help and would add up quickly. Do I agree with the what's been said and done? I think there's a difference between making a statement, as we've seen them with Mass and Cass, on saying we are ending the ability to, or we're sort of noting that we have limited space, but yet people still continue to come. And so the real question ends up being, how do we work together to manage the reality of what will still take place, even after official policy statements and declarations have been made. And we've been very, very grateful for the state's partnership, and the governor and her team have been doing everything possible in an impossible situation. And we will be backing them up as we continue to try to find space for new arrivals and work with them to find ways to expedite the legal processes at the federal level, but also to work with families who already have their work authorizations. And then if we can line up the direct workforce pipelines, the more we can expedite everyone getting on their feet, the more efficiently the system itself will run and can actually function as a temporary safety net rather than the kind of more permanent use it's taken on because the bureaucracy has clogged up everything.
So let's go to school for a couple of minutes. Yesterday, you were at the Boston Green Academy with the grand opening of a new outdoor classroom. The city's launching 10 new raised bed garden programs in various Boston public schools across the city. I find that particularly interesting because the city has been a place where sort of brown space farming has been something that has really emerged. Urban farming is a real possibility and something that's growing in the city. What's the goal with bringing these raised bed gardens to the Boston Public Schools? What do you want kids to learn as they're engaging that way?
Our overall goal is for Boston to be the best city for families, and that means creating the whole child, whole family, whole community experiences and opportunities to grow. So we're going to have excellent, top-notch academics, and there's so much we're doing on that front. We're going to have, in addition to that, every child growing up in Boston learning how to swim for free, learning how to ride a bike, having the chance to play sports, to be involved in the arts, and to get their hands dirty in the dirt and in nature. This is part of what we call our learn, connect, and explore commitment, to really wrap around what it means to be a kid and explore your and feel connected to the larger world. Everything that we need to, some of our most pressing global challenges right now around climate and in Boston, that translating into flooding, rain, and heat. Green infrastructure is the solution for that. We just got a major grant with Senator Markey and our federal delegation's leadership from the U.S. Forest Service to boost our tree canopy in Boston and close gaps, 10-degree temperature difference between Chinatown, where there aren't many trees, and the more wooded areas of the city. And we can use that funding to buy trees, but in fact, the biggest limiting factor is workforce. We need such an investment in the people who will be around to plan, design, staff up, plant, maintain all kinds of green infrastructure. And so if we can not only inspire our kids to integrate their science and math curriculums and biology with the outdoor gardens that they can actually learn in and see in real time what that feels like, but inspire a larger love and understanding of these issues that will be the driving issues for their safety and future and for their economic prospects as well. That's a really great way to brighten up our schools and prepare all of us. There are, as you said, there are 10 new ones,
yeah,
but there are some 87 schools that already have some kind of outdoor learning space, whether it's a garden or an outdoor classroom. And so we're going to continue growing that until every single one of our schools has that opportunity.
When I was little, I helped my Nona keep one rose bush. Did you get to did you get to grow any plants when you were a kid?
Yeah, my mom has quite the green thumb, and so there were indoor plants, there were outdoor, and we still, now that she lives with me, we have a very small outdoor space. She likes to have a kind of free-flowing wild experience. We kind of compromised, a little wilder than I like it to look, but it definitely was a chance to bring some vegetables that you could only get from the Chinese grocery store very far away and have them right at home too.
All right, so I wanna go back to some of the bigger policy issues. We talked at the beginning of this conversation about this you know, are our policies keeping up with? So, you know, right to shelter law, is it keeping up with the moment? Governor Healey has argued that it is not, right? You're asking for change in policy from the Boston City Council because, you know, it's not keeping up with mass and cast. The police contract is out of date. You want a new one. Negotiations continue on a contract between the city and the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. We're in arbitration now. You've expressed concern. Dismay would not be appropriate. You've expressed concern about that. You've also said we have to have a contract that has reform in it. Elizabeth and West Roxbury texted, we have to get rid of binding arbitration and public union contracts. The community needs to have faith in the police, and some of the abuses are outrageous. Is the mayor working with the legislature to address this? So first, do you want to see that change? Are you working with the legislature to get rid of arbitration in contracts, in city contracts?
We are biting off a small piece of having that greater predictability, which is just even trying to do this through the negotiation process of carving out some categories of misconduct or types of disciplinary actions that would not need to go through arbitration and kind of questioning of the commissioner's decision to terminate someone. That has been one thing that has been on the table and going back and forth. And you know, some of these internal processes, given the way previous contract language had run, would sometimes be 2 years, 3 years before there was resolution to pretty egregious action that had taken place. And no one's trying to remove a due process or a thorough kind of determination of facts and what happened. But if there are certain things that certain actions are just incompatible with serving the public. If you have been convicted of certain kinds of violence, right, you know, whatever the context is, and even off duty, that is just not compatible with serving and protecting the public. If you've been involved in certain kinds of hate crimes or this or that. So we are trying to do our part through the contract to institute that, along with some of the other reforms that are both important for public transparency and use of public resources, but also for officer health and well-being, and be able to address the overtime challenges that are exacerbated with certain policies that have been on the books.
Is the contract still in arbitration, Mayor Wu?
It is.
Okay. So you have said in other radio interviews, you have suggested that if it doesn't contain some reforms that are key for you, it's conceivable you wouldn't sign it, that there's a level of reform that is fundamental to you in any finalized police contract. I want to push on that a little bit, because last month we spoke with Boston Police Commissioner Michael Cox about the contract and reform within the department, and this is what he told us.
That word, it's a little charged, reform. There are best practices, and when you run something, you should run it well, and it doesn't matter what the industries are. You know, and so there are things that we can do and I'm trying to do and that we will continue to do to make us be a well-run organization. Police departments have tons of rules. We have hundreds, if not thousands, of rules. The rules are already there. The issue are the officers following it? Do they understand what they are? Do we routinely make sure that they not only understand what they're supposed to do, but we check to make sure that they're doing it? Do we praise them for when they're doing it? Do we discipline and hold them accountable when they don't?
So does the commissioner share the level of urgency that you do for new reforms in this contract? Are the two of you aligned on what you're saying you need to see in any finalized new contract with the police unions?
Yes, I feel so lucky every day that Commissioner Michael Cox agreed to come back home to Boston and serve in this role. I stand by him 100% on the initiatives that he's been moving forward, and there's complete alignment in his vision for the Boston Police and how that can be more responsive and connected to community partnerships. I think some of what we're talking about in the current stage of contract, arbitration and negotiation, is not necessarily about some of the rules that he was referencing. There are many rules, and those are the purview of the department and OPAT, the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency, to work through and see where there might be changes that are needed. But in terms of contract negotiations, it's about the policies that can affect disciplinary procedures or overtime. And we need to do everything that we can to ensure we're giving officers a sustainable work-life balance as well. When there are ways to stay on medical leave for multiple years at a time without resolving that, that means that someone always on leave for over a year, and at one point, more than 10% had been on the force, 10% of the force had been on leave for over a year earlier on, immediately post-pandemic. There has to be a mechanism, otherwise that gets filled in with forced overtime from others, and then that strains the force, and people are working every single weekend throughout the summer without time with their family. So all of this ultimately comes back down to having a functioning department for the residents of Boston, but also for the officers themselves, and making this a profession that is important. And, you know, it's not for everyone, but it has to be sustainable. And we need to value the people who are taking these risks and serving the public.
Does it remain possible that there could be a contract that comes out of arbitration that you wouldn't sign?
I think it's possible. We've been using the arbitration process a little bit differently than I think has been approached in the past. And there was a lot of research that went into exactly what mechanisms we could use. Historically, it has just been for deciding the right salary level. And each side presents a proposal, and it ends up being somewhere in the middle based on recent research into what other departments across the Commonwealth have received and this and that. But in fact, you can submit 5 issues before the arbitrators, and those don't have to be around compensation. And so we have put forward more, you know, some of the other items that were on the table that really are about the reforms we've been discussing. And there will need to be some addressing of all of those issues in addition to compensation. And I suppose it's conceivable that all of them could end up, you know, completely getting kicked off. But the way that the process is generally structured, that seems unlikely, but we shall see.
All right. In our last 30 seconds, my last question for you. Tomorrow on Radio Boston, we have a conversation with Andrea Campbell, who is one of 3 women who read audio for a statue, the Boston Women's Memorial. She is Abigail Adams. Ayanna Pressley is Phyllis Wheatley, and you're Lucy Stone. We'll have that story tomorrow. Lucy Stone was an abolitionist. What did it mean for you to read one of the women of history?
It was a delight. I had a little fun. She's a little saucy. She's very independent. And I was projecting a little bit too much, but it was quite enjoyable. And I'm so grateful to everyone involved in that project.
Well, we'll have a little sound of it on our show tomorrow so people can come back for that. For now, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.